Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does urban planning influence the way people live within a community or how happy they are? Are the best cities and towns the ones that develop organically or those that count on strict preordained standards designed to control and guide their growth? Supporters of the new urbanism movement are convinced that smart, comprehensive planning is key to ensuring that communities are safe, sustainable, and socially connected. They like neighborhoods where residents are within walking distance of everyday stores and services, navigable streets are close and have access to public transit, and that they are architecturally cohesive and often traditional in design. But does it really work? And how scalable are new urban community plans to existing neighborhoods? Andres Duany is an architect and urban planner whose DPZ firm has been a world leader in the sometimes controversial new urbanism movement. He's in town to address several events sponsored by the North Texas chapter of the Congress for New Urbanism. Andres, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Would you give us a sense of what new urbanism aims to do and how it is different from the reality of urban life for most Americans?
Well, there are really two urbanisms in America now to choose from. One is the traditional towns and neighborhoods that were walkable and diverse, which generally were what we had prior to the Second World War, and then a whole new model, the post-war, what has come to be seen as suburban sprawl, in which the automobile is essential for all ordinary daily needs. And all of us have been in both places. There are reasons for both. There are societies that generated them. But the suburban sprawl, the new urbanists have always thought would crash. It was essentially unsustainable. It required a great deal of public wealth to build the infrastructure, private wealth to own the cars. And furthermore, it was unecological and also socially a lot of social segregation, a lot of isolation, not serving the old who don't like driving and not serving the young who don't have licenses yet. So we said there's a problem here, and the new urbanism was born of critique. And basically what we said is there – and this is often misunderstood. We don't want to go back to the historical models. We want to select from both whatever each of them does well. For example, we very much appreciate the traditional Main Street where you are outdoors, you know, smaller merchants, but we like to see them managed as a modern shopping mall would manage them. That's a typical hybrid. We do not want to ban cars, but we would like the car to be an option. You know, you can walk, but if you don't feel like walking, you can also drive. There's plenty of parking. So it's all about increasing choice. And I think that that's where the success has been, which is a market success. I mean, now it's being taken up by environmental movements, but it's essentially a market success. People like it. And I don't know how that could possibly be controversial, you know, increasing choice and doing something that people is not imposed on people, but that people appreciate and pay for.
Right, because, of course, at the turn of the century, people didn't really have a choice. They didn't have access to their own automobile in most cases.
Right. And actually now, they don't have choice either. Like when you live in suburban sprawl, which is what, you know, most jurisdictions, that's all that's being provided is suburban sprawl. And it's essentially inaccessible to people who don't have cars. I sometimes think about how careful we are with people who are in wheelchairs and the ramp here and the ramp there and the elevator. And yet we're looking at the suburban sprawl, which is inaccessible to 50% of the population, who must be driven around, you know. And it's really unfair to them.
Why did we become so enamored of the idea of moving far away from center cities and having our own little patch of land?
Well, from the beginning, of course, we left England and left Spain. You know, there's almost like natural selection. Americans have been people who have left and moved on to find better places. And there's always been a history in this country from, the New England settlements are like European. There are people, exiles from Europe, and then over the Appalachians, and we never stopped. And so at some level, it's a tradition of going out and trying to get it right, you know, that utopian American, that compelling utopia, the idealism of Americans. And suburbia was really an attempt to finally get the city right, particularly after the decay. You know, certain, I would say, policy mistakes were made, you know, in the post-war period that caused the cities to lose value and to become essentially crime-prone and expensive to live in. And so Americans left to try again. And what we have is a kind of parody of that. You know, not the intelligent, for example, new towns that were built, like Columbia and Reston, you know, that were really comprehensive attempts to do cities, quote-unquote, right, but a kind of ridiculous cartoon version of what suburbia was meant to be. Of course, that's what's normal. And, you know, and Dallas is famous worldwide as the incubator and testbed of suburban sprawl.
Drive until you qualify.
Well, the North Dallas Special, the McMansion, the original name of the McMansion was the North Dallas Special. It was incubated here.
What can we learn about the way so many European cities were rebuilt after the Second World War?
Well, we don't have to go as far as Europe. We can go to Canada. And let's just talk about Canada. Now, take 1945. We had gone through a depression and a war. 15 years of essentially no maintenance. No investment, no maintenance. And the houses that you found in 1929, at the beginning of the Depression, didn't have insulation, didn't have many huge number didn't have indoor plumbing. They didn't, you know, they were first generation, very low-tech buildings, and they weren't maintained. So in 1945, you find the cities in sorry shape. And the U.S. government, in order to avoid the depression that would have ensued with the cutting off of the armaments, came up with essentially very, very cheap loans. You know, the VA loans, the FHA loans that said, you know, the 30-year loans that basically said $500 down and $50 a month and you get a new house. They did not give these cheap loans for renovation. And that was the crucial policy problem. So let's say you live downtown in a nice Victorian house, downtown Dallas, and your house was decrepit. You did not get the cheap loan to fix it, but you did get the cheap loan to move out. Canada didn't do that. The Canadian equivalent of the funding was also for renovation. So there wasn't that compelling. It was simply a policy mistake. And now you think of Canadian cities, Toronto, Vancouver, you name it. You know, Quebec, Montreal, and they're all doing well. And that was one of the initial policy differences. And Europe, it was the same. So we made that mistake. We exacerbated that mistake with turning the highway system into basically a commuting system. You know, it was supposed to be an interstate commercial system connecting the states. Now we use the interstates to get coffee or get to work. It's ridiculous misuse of that expense. And one thing after the other, we have created a kind of monster which was sustainable so long as we were amazingly wealthy as a society. We could pay for all that infrastructure, pay for the very inefficient services of picking up kids in school buses, delivering the mail with 200,000 little jeeps. We could pay for, you know, lots of firehouses. And then we could count on people. That's private expenditure. And then we could count on people to buy cars, one per adult. We were rich enough to do that. And so the whole thing worked. Began to crash for various reasons. We couldn't keep up with the building of construction. And now, of course, it has comprehensively crashed. And we have a thoroughgoing rethinking. And suburban sprawl, no less than any other environmental crime, is now a culprit. You know, no less than paving over wetlands, no less than having fuel-hungry cars, no less than many of the things that we have found were untenable, suburban sprawl is coming to be seen as a huge part of the problem. It isn't just that the buildings are not green buildings. It's just that if a green building is in the suburb and you have to drive to it, you're still loading up the atmosphere with carbon by getting there, even if the building itself might be, let's say, a green building. So it's being discovered and completely. And in this, the new urbanists, because we've been in the critical edge for 25 years, the new urbanists are front and center, writing solutions, for example, with LEED-ND, the standard writers for the green buildings. We're also working with the Institute of Transportation Engineers. to make roads that are good for cars and pedestrians and bikes. They're called complete streets. We're helping to write all those standards.
I think clearly there are a lot of people, if they don't already have this situation, who absolutely fantasize about the ability to work and play and shop within a very close perimeter from where they live.
Yes, yes.
Of course, you have the reality, though, of a lot of couples where two different adults have jobs in two different areas, and what they do is pick a place that may not be convenient to either one, but is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Well, nothing's perfect, although you can approach it. You can, for example, you know, most of the driving is not getting to work. It's the dopey little errands you make all day. We spend a huge amount of time in the car, not least driving kids around, who a generation or two ago could walk to the baseball game.
And probably still could in some neighborhoods.
In some neighborhoods, walk to friends, go off and get their own grilled cheese sandwich on, you know, at the drugstore on Saturday, that kind of thing, is in the memory of a lot of people. It wasn't that long ago. Now that's impossible, and the parents become chauffeurs. So it isn't just the job, which I agree with you, would have to work that way. But, for example, these neighborhoods, if they're fitted to transit, a bus or rail could stop in them, and the couple could go to their different places without necessarily owning one more car. You know, but remember this. Whatever we do in urbanism requires a generation to work. We can put in one place the exact ratio of housing of different incomes, of all the necessary shops for ordinary daily needs, the right number of school classrooms, and we can put the sports fields, and we can, you know, and you can have the nanny for the rich folk and the janitor and the principal, everybody in one place. And still it would take a generation before the shops are right, before the jobs are nearby, you know. People, because they move into a new urbanist community, don't give up their job 15 miles away. You know, it has to mold. And so we await. I think the oldest community is about 20 years old. The bigger ones are about 10, 12 years old. And you simply have to wait to see them operate. But right from the beginning, people do an enormous amount of walking, more than they would otherwise.
One thing we haven't talked much about is the fact that this is not just about putting these facilities and structures in place for people to use and making sure that transportation is close by. There's also a very strict system of codes to ensure that everything sort of stays the way the plan goes. Will you talk about the most important laws to make sure that things work the way you intend them to?
Well, okay. I think most people don't realize that America is coded. Everything we do except Houston, is subject to codes. The problem that new urbanists have had, so we're not working off an uncoded condition. The country is full of codes. Problem is that the codes envision suburban sprawl. So in order for us to overcome the existing codes, we've had to write alternate codes. Because, you know, you can never replace a code with nothing. People get terrified. Bureaucrats lose their job. You know,
it feels like anarchy.
Anarchy. And above all, there's resistance to the unknown. So we always have replaced old codes with new codes. And the new codes, of course, allow compact, walkable, diverse communities, which the old ones do not. The old codes separate the housing from the shops, from the office parks. And they separate the townhouse clusters from the mansions, from the rental units. You know, so everybody's segregated. The suburbs have everything you need to make neighborhoods, but disassembled. What the new urbanist codes do, and by the way, that is administered by the existing conventional codes. What the new urbanists do is we take these elements and assemble them into neighborhoods.
Andres Ruani is here. He is an architect and urban planner and a leader in the new urbanism movement. We'll resume our conversation in just a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking today about the new urbanism movement with one of the leaders worldwide in that movement, Andres Duany. He's in town to make appearances this afternoon at UT Arlington, and he will be this evening at SMU. The events are sponsored by the North Texas Congress for New Urbanism. You can find information at their website or on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at KERA.org. So, Andres, why does this make people happier than living elsewhere and sort of having everything they need? What's so special about this formula of setting up the way cities and communities work?
Well, new urbanism at its best increases choice. You know, it allows you not only to drive, but to walk. It allows not only the big box, which we're not particularly interested in banning, but also the small merchant. You know, it allows a grandparent to move into an outbuilding in the children's house, you know, which is normally illegal to have a second dwelling. It allows you, for example, to have younger people, because there's a range of housing types in close proximity. It allows younger people to live with older people, you know, which means your kids can be nearby, but on their own house. It allows real urban living, not just density, but real urbanity, which requires new codes, you know, to have buildings close to the street and housing above shops. And it also allows true, if you're in suburbia, it allows true suburbia, okay? True suburbia with dirt streets, not what now passes for suburbia, which is you pretend to have a big lot, but the entire infrastructure is just like downtown Houston, you know, and it's not country at all. For example, we write codes that allow chickens, you know, which, of course, is usually banned. So basically, we're all about increasing choice and allowing people to decide where to live, thereby allowing happiness to be self-defined. We're very impressed by the greatest marketing slogan of all time, which is that if you come to this country, you get life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's a uniquely rosy promise. Just to give you a comparison, you know, Canadians have freedom, order, and good government. If you're going to emigrate, which one would you choose?
Well, Canada sounds less sexy for sure.
Much less sexy. But, you know, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, get me there. Well, these are the founding fathers. They knew what they were doing, and they know that government is about enabling people not only to rise economically, okay, but also to not work all that hard if they don't want to. I'm now working in New Orleans, and I'm trying to do affordable housing that can be delivered at such a low cost that people don't have to work that hard, because part of the culture of New Orleans is leisure. You know, all this music, all this live music requires time to rehearse, time to listen. The New Orleans cuisine requires you to cook all day, you know. If you have a party in New Orleans, you prepare for days. I mean, it's seriously done, the costumes, et cetera. And that requires leisure. And we're working in New Orleans after the hurricane quite a lot. I have a house there. And what we have found is that the government housing, although the government, the federal government, is very generous giving money to people to rebuild their houses, they have inadvertently raised the price of the houses of new construction by raising the standards. You know, by the time you're done, quote-unquote, raising the standards to meet the toughest hurricane, the house, which was $70,000, cost $140,000. So the government gives you $70,000, which would have paid for the old kind of house, but the new one costs $140,000, which means you're in debt anyway. The minute you're in debt in New Orleans, you need two jobs, and you can't do the culture of New Orleans. So we realize that. We say, yes, the people are safer, and some people will choose that in these new houses, but people also have a right to live the old way, you know, to perhaps take a risk with their housing so that they don't have to work that hard so that they can continue making music and working, let's say, 3 days a week instead of five or six. That is a typical new urbanist attitude. It's to actually, in that case, suspend codes, remove the onerous nanny state building codes that are causing housing to be expensive. So what is the common thread through the new urbanism is increasing choice, so that this American promise of happiness, as self-defined, not as conceived by some expert, can be attainable to most people.
So you've talked about choice. One thing that your critics will point to is the lack of choice in some of these master planned areas in terms of the way a structure appears from the street.
Yes.
Why do you care so much about that?
Well, there are two things. There's style, and the style, actually, most people, particularly architects, don't like what our buildings look like, and they don't know that actually that's because the market likes that.
We should say they often look like more traditional
buildings. Yes, they look like more
buildings.
Traditional, right. I can do, and I have been much of my life a modernist architect, okay, and I'm not a bad one. I've received awards and so forth for modern architecture, but I don't impose that on people who want to live in a traditional house. You see, we're not ideologues. Modern architects are ideologues. Traditionalist architects are ideologues. You know, they believe their way is best. We enable people to choose. For example, Seaside, our first community, has 10% modernist buildings. Excellent. A place in Colorado called Prospect that we designed, a town we designed, has 70% modernist structures because that's what the market called for. Now, that's different from the question you asked, which is the building meeting the street. How the building meets the street supports or undermines pedestrianism. If all you have is garage doors in front, then it's a very boring and hostile walk, and people will tend to not walk. If you have porches and the cars are behind, people will tend to walk because it's much more interesting, it's much more sociable. For example, we're working now with a series of agricultural communities, and we're putting the gardens in front. The vegetable gardens, because we have discovered, and I suppose we should have known earlier, that gardens give rise to a great deal of social interaction.
Sure, you're out there working, and you see the neighbors out there working.
Yeah. And you ask about the carrots and so forth. And by the way, sitting in a porch, you can do, but not do that much, because leisure is not very much our ideal. But you might be standing out there holding a hoe, and that, in fact, you can do that a lot longer than sitting in a rocking chair. And you also have conversation pieces, the vegetables, how's it going, when did you plant, like what fertilizer, where'd you get your seeds. And so what we want in the end, the walkability, there are many reasons for that, health, support of transit, but above all, the forming of community. And when you drive around, it's impossible to form community because you're in a hostile relationship to your other driver, to your fellow driver. Because you're competing with asphalt. So basically, you have a negative relationship to your community if everyone's driving. But if you walk, at least there's a chance that you engage in, you know, some kind of human interaction. And that makes political decisions a lot more intelligent. Like, as you know, some of the dumbest votes that take place are based on the fear of people of less income. And frankly, many people don't know what people of less income are like because they never get to see them. You know, they live in an archipelago of the expensive community, the expensive stores, you know, the private school, the club, and then they share the streets, sure, but the people of less income are in another archipelago. And when you don't get to know the person personally, you begin to fear them. And actually, that person that has less income is like your school teacher, the school teacher of your child. It's your kid. It's you when you were younger. For example, but people who live in these not quite walled communities, but paranoid communities that don't want anybody of lesser income in, simply don't know what they're talking about because they haven't met the people. Now, wherever people walk, they find that people not exactly like themselves are really okay, and so the bonds of community are formed, and it's the only way democracy can move forward, you know, is with a certain amount of solidarity at the community scale, not just at the family level or the corporate level, but the community as a whole is the level of design that interests us.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Andres Duany, who is in town to address the North Texas chapter of the Congress for New Urbanism. Let's go first to Scott in Plano. Hello, Scott.
Hi, yes, I'm a longtime fan of Mr. Duany, and as a former practicing city planner, I'm familiar with his work and the evils of how the old style has been done. But in listening to you talk just now, I'm particularly interested whether you in particular personally or others in the working in this new urbanism tradition have been influenced by that great chronicler of American cities, Jane Jacobs?
Oh, yes. We were, you know, we're of the age that were brought up when the only sane person was Jane Jacobs. Yes. By the way, if you're in Plano, we designed that the Town Center Legacy, you know, which is largely built out. Do you know what I'm speaking of?
I'm assuming he does. Can you talk a little bit? Tell us a little bit about Legacy.
Well, Legacy was in front of, Ross Perot's outfit, EDS. And there was just a huge site there. And basically the people working at Legacy were commuting very long distances. They were commuting to lunch, et cetera. And the people at EDS said, could we basically take this setback in front, this huge setback, and build a community there? Which we did, including apartments, hotels, shops, restaurants, and it's quite walkable. It's only about 200 acres, but there's a lot there. So those who live in Plano have a chance to see it. That was designed by our firm. And, of course, there's the Great Addison Circle just down the street from Plano.
Does new urbanism sort of assume that people eventually will be willing, even in Texas, in the land of the McMansions, to give up 6,000 square feet in favor of a shorter commute and more deep relationships with their neighbors?
The assumption is that not everyone ever will do that. But, every time we design a new community, which must be market-based, studies are done, and always a percentage of the population comes in and says, we've been waiting all our lives for these places. We wish they were available. Now, that can range from 30% in some places, like in the South, in the American South, where they don't have so much sprawl. They don't hate it as much. Texas, perhaps, where this is a wealthy enough state that you're not as impinged by the bankruptcy, really, that ensues when you have to build too much infrastructure. You're just too rich to really have it bother you much. But there are other places where, so in places like Texas, 30% maybe, waiting for a new urbanist community. But other places are 60% and 70% and 80%. So, but it's never 100, by the way. And it's one of the reasons that our codes always allow suburbia. You know, we never design a place that doesn't have an increment of suburbia because we don't want to impose, you know, what we might consider to be our ideal on other people who have the ideal of having the garage door in front and driving everywhere.
Well, there's a lot of existing houses that have that already. Can you remake those communities?
Well, that's the most interesting question. By the way, I should say that everything that was known 6 months ago has changed. And what the market was 6 months ago is different. And I would say that right now, even the big builders are, for example, I think KB Homes is now building houses of 1,400 square feet and very proud of it. You know, these are the people who built the who've been pushing it up. Everything has changed because the old stuff is not only bankrupt, as it were, it bankrupted us, all of us, but it is also overbuilt. So there's a huge inventory that still has to be gone through. So anybody who wants to build anything now needs to do something different. And so, yes, virtually everything that's being built is different. So this is all very new. But the newest of the new is the retrofitting of suburbia because as it is progressively discovered that with the scarcity of petroleum, with how driving around affects the atmosphere, you know, it's where the carbon comes from, the consumption of land, it suddenly becomes uncool. Not only unpleasant, it always was, not only time-consumptive, at least suburbia was cool. You know, you put up with the commute, but it was cool. It's now uncool. It's uncool the way SUVs are uncool. It's Hummers are uncool, right? But we can't throw it away. We can't throw the McMansions away. We can't throw the shopping centers, the office parks, particularly the shopping malls. And our biggest new urbanist agenda coming up, and there's a Congress that will take place in June in Albuquerque, which will be in Denver. The discussion will be how to retrofit suburbia. And one of our board members, Ellen Dunham Jones, has written a book published a month ago called Retrofitting Suburbia that collects all that is known and has been done in this regard. And she'll be lecturing actually at SMU today at 1:30. with her book.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak with Amanda. Hey, Amanda.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I just wanted to touch on one of the points he made about lower income. My husband and I live in one of these pre-war inner ring cities here in Fort Worth, and we love it. I mean, it's kind of the best of both worlds. We have a yard, but we're, you know, you can walk to the bus and things like that. But my question is, how do we get these types of neighborhoods attractive to people who might otherwise choose the suburbs without making them too expensive for the people that already live there? You know, we don't want property taxes to go through the roof or anything like that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
I don't know whether it would be a new urbanist proposition to use that word, make people do that. You know, there are other groups that are closely associated with us who write policy and who work at a larger scale, for example, smart growth. The smart growth policies, by redirecting where the infrastructure gets built, if it's redirected to neighborhoods like yours, for example, the streets are better maintained, the transit there is better subsidized rather than in the suburbs, then you essentially are making people choose the inner city suburbs. But I think that there's no easy answer. There's no single answer. And so I want you to know that there are a lot of people working on this, a lot of organizations, and they have different attitudes and different tools. The new urbanists, we like to think of ourselves, although we write policy, we think of ourselves as market-driven. You know, people have to want to do it. And just give us a chance and give them the choice.
Amanda Nestorani is my guest. He's in town for the North Texas Congress for New Urbanism. You can find information about his appearances on the Think page of KERA.org. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a leader in the new urbanism movement, Andres Duany. He is in town to address the North Texas chapter of the Congress for New Urbanism. You can find information about those appearances that will take place today at UT Arlington and at SMU on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is think@KERA.org. Let's go on the phones now to Bill in Euless. Hi, Bill.
Yes, hello. I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with one of Mark Knopfler's tunes of 2004. It's called Boom Like That, and it describes Ray Kroc and his rise to form McDonald's and to franchise and to open up the markets with them. And the question of what do you do with the franchises to include Walmart, which is the monster that's been killing little towns all across the country. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Walmart is, in fact, the monster that progressively has been killing, and as a matter of policy, has been killing the main streets. And you may know that they first build a Walmart outside of the small town. It sells everything that the merchants do. The merchants die, and then once there's no competition, they'll take three medium Walmarts and build one great one for the sake of their efficiency, and then you have to drive 20 miles to get your needs. What people don't understand about Walmart is that their efficiency is because you subsidize them by very long drives. You know, while the merchant is more expensive, you know, your mom-and-pop store, but you're not subsidizing by drive. They're essentially doing precise delivery to you. Now, what Walmart, because they are the smartest people conceivable, what they'll be doing, I predict this, is they will be creating smaller and smaller format stores that can work within the cities. And because, in fact, they provide at very reasonable prices ordinary things, not luxuries, people will welcome it. They're going to become like department stores. You know, a Walmart's going to become like the old Five and Dime. It's going to become like the old, you know, the old department store that died that you regret having lost from your main street. I predict that eventually Walmart will have those smaller formats as they evolve into the much more walkable 21st century. And yes, you have to keep beating up on them so that they hurry to get there, but they're not going to go away. They're just too efficient and too smart.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Hannah in Dallas. Hey, Hannah.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Okay, my question is, I'm an architect from Sweden, and in my opinion, architects in the U.S. aren't very concerned with urban planning, and my question is, why do you think that is?
Well, they used to be. I think that the current generation of architects is not very concerned, partially because of the failure of the last time they were concerned. You know, the U.S. architects had a tremendous chance in the post-war period with the Model Cities program, which allowed entire neighborhoods to be developed and architects to impose their new ideas, which were the high-rises in the park. Now, as you know, those high-rises, often called HUD housing, went very bad socially. They basically imploded socially and became crime-prone. And so architects said, this doesn't work, and they withdrew into a kind of self-referential profession in which we say we only care about ourselves, we the architects. We will design for each other. We will affect only the history of architecture. Whenever we have attempted to affect society, it's backfired. It's best that we don't do it. And as a result of that, the design of urban planning is very bad in this country because the architects have withdrawn. You still get urban planning, but you get urban planning by people who are statisticians or engineers, principally engineers, and so you have this very inferior kinds of cities that we have now. Now, the new urbanists have a very high proportion of architects. We are the first group since the 50s of urban planners that are primarily architects, and so our design, we combine the social concerns of urban planners, the generalism that is required of designing cities. You know, we need to know engineering, we need to know water handling, we need to know landscape and environmentalism. So we combine all of these general fields of knowledge with design. So what you were saying about architects not being concerned is very true, but the new urbanists are different. We are architects and we are concerned.
We have an email here from Lauren who says, I love the idea of new urbanism and sustainable living, and I live at Legacy. But while the parking lots are packed, the apartments are not. There are no grocery stores, pharmacies, or similar day-to-day necessities. I realize Mr. Duane said it would take a generation for the stores to sort themselves out. But is that the only explanation for this gap between ideal and actual use, at least here in North Texas?
Well, unfortunately, I don't know. You know, there have been many changes at EDS. As you know, Ross Perot sold it and so forth. And at some point, we lost track of that project. And although the codes were in place to build it out, the codes are not so precise that they force groceries to go in. And if in fact, you're not supplied by ordinary daily needs, then obviously something is wrong. And it could be that the people in charge don't understand and simply are getting top dollar for the stores. So if a dress shop pays more rent, they're not going to move the grocer out or not even think of the grocer. But, you know, history is long, and it won't be very many more years before it's evident that that which anchors the housing, which makes the housing more valuable, is really going to be the grocery store and the drugstore and not just one more dress store from which you can buy in the internet anyway. And that's what I mean by the long run. Getting it right in the long run implies getting it wrong several times. And seems to me that legacy, and every place has its own history, probably has the wrong kind of retail. It's probably all entertainment retail based on the conference center of the hotel. As I remember, there was a good number of expensive restaurants and so forth, you know, places to stay up at night. And that was the highest and best use, you know, back in the 90s and early 20th century. And I suspect that the highest and best use from now on is going to be something like useful stores. So don't give up. And by the way, part of what constitutes urbanism are the citizens getting what they want. So if you live in legacy, don't hesitate to make your view known. Find out who's in charge, even if it's the politicians, and say, we believe that environmentally what is best is if we didn't have to walk, we didn't have to drive to ordinary daily needs like groceries. Could you please persuade or induce this? So it's also in your hands, you know. There are going to be no saviors coming from the sky. It's going to be you getting together with your fellow citizens and making it happen.
I wonder about the extent to which some of that arises from the fact that a place like Legacy, at least initially, really appeals to young, educated people who may not have any kids and don't initially think that a close grocery store or pharmacy where you can go and get a prescription at 4 o'clock in the morning are that important, at least when they first move in.
Yes, sure. What those people which you described are concerned about is how many places can I go where I can meet somebody for a date, you know, which are, of course, the restaurants and bars that stay up late at night, the music venues and so forth. However, the seniors, the baby boomers are now retiring, you know, reaching 16, 65 at a tremendous rate. And this appeals to them, too, because you can't drive around when you're old. You know, you think you can, but it's really unpleasant, progressively dangerous. Eventually, you end up making only right turns. And then really what happens is you end up in a retirement community, which is horrible. What you should be looking for is a neighborhood where you can stay living independently and walking to your daily needs. Last three weeks ago, we worked for the Atlanta Regional Council specifically to retrofit the suburbs of Atlanta. Listen to this, for seniors. And it was a joint charrette with the Regional Council and the AARP, the Society of Retirement. You know, the old folks.
American Association of Retired People.
American Association of Retired People. I was going to say persons, but it's people. And there you have it. It was, and what we discovered with all the consultants, 8 days of work is what we knew anyway, that suburbia as currently built is dreadful for older folk, dreadful. It makes no sense whatsoever for them. And that's why they go to retirement communities at great cost to, you know, be fed in a cafeteria and go to the mall in a little bus twice a week, you know, because they just can't make it in their houses. Why not provide them with, you know, a neighborhood where they can get around, they can walk to their social and really daily needs, functional needs, including medicine. You know, they can go to the doctor can show up once or twice a week at a clinic and check them out without, you know, needing special drivers and so forth. And it was a revelation to the AARP that such a place would be, that a traditional neighborhood would be a great thing. You know what they call them? They call them naturally occurring retirement communities, NORCs, which are the surviving neighborhoods that older folk have identified and moved to.
As opposed to a place like Sun City that is specifically created.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Specifically created. And by the way, at great cost. It's very costly to be there.
How close are those communities to the ideals of new urbanism, accepting the fact that they are for people only of a specific age?
They can be retrofitted relatively easily. You know, you cannot say, these days we're talking about not whether they're pure new urbanist or very distant from new urbanism. The question is, can they be retrofitted? Like, for example, shopping malls are very distant from new urbanist conceptions. They're monocultures. You can only shop there. On the other hand, they have a huge amount of open space, which are the parking lots, that can become places for offices and places for apartments and so forth, so they become mixed use. They're also beautifully located for transit stops, because they're always on the big arterials. They're perfectly spaced for bus stops, for bus rapid transit. And in fact, the neighbors would welcome the transformation. So there isn't even the resistance that you find when you say, I'm going to build a high-density place. People would like to have a town center rather more than a dead mall. So the question to ask is, to what extent can this be retrofitted into a new urbanist community? The malls are very high. Now, paradoxically, the single-family McMansion communities have a very low potential for that because the homeowners associations prevent them from being transformed. You know, they're very rigid.
Do you imagine a generation from now that we could see neighborhoods where instead of tearing down little single-family and duplex houses and putting up McMansions, we will tear down McMansions and put smaller or higher
density? Well, it depends on the design of the McMansion. We've tested this several times. Some McMansions can easily become multiple apartments. You know, we did one in this ARC Charette in Atlanta that we turned into a boarding house, and a four-bedroom, five-bath house easily became, listen to this, a 13-bedroom, 13-bath house.
Good heavens.
And it wasn't even such a large McMansion.
And every resident gets a bedroom
their
and
own
bathroom.
So. Which means it's a boarding house, mm-hmm. Which is a wonderful way to retire. And by the way, we still had the living room, the dining room, and the family room free. So, yes, they have a future as that. They also, but, you know, what other future do they have? It depends. It depends. Some of the designs are so inflexible that they have a future only as sites for salvage. You know, there'll be people taking them apart and building somewhere else. And I expect that quite a few of them will be abandoned. And some of them maybe will become something like agricultural buildings. But they have a very difficult future, these late model subdivisions that are so far out with houses that are so energy consumptive. And may I add, don't forget this, are shortly going to be considered incredibly uncool. You know, because in America, we still have the luxury to decide that things are cool and uncool, not just functional and dysfunctional. And suburbia is certainly becoming uncool. That's not only sort of bankrupt, as we know, but also really not. It's like having a big-engined car, which used to be very cool very recently. The McMansion has a similar future.
In the few seconds we have left, what does the suburb look like in America in 50 years?
In 50 years, now that's a difficult question. I'll tell you why. Because there may be a lot of social insecurity arising from the new poverty. You know, there may be a lot of poor people. There may be a lot of people crossing borders as the South gets hotter with global warming. And it may be that they look more like medieval cities, which there's no precedent in America. They'll be very new.
Andres Duany is in town to address several events sponsored by the North Texas chapter of the Congress for New Urbanism. It has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.